Once again, dear listeners, welcome to Food Conversations Season 8. Before we begin, of course, we cannot forget that we live and work in Sukupmakulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Squepik people. Every day it becomes clearer that doing the best we can to restore this historical injustice is a critical responsibility for all of us. Now, most listeners who have lived in the Shuswap for a few years will be familiar with the name of our guest today. They may know him as an advocate for forest conservation or as an environmental activist with the group SEAS, the Shuswap Environmental Action Society, or as the author of the popular book Everything Shuswap, or the long-running newspaper and digital column Shuswap Passion, or as the local music impresario behind concerts at the Passion Bowl and other venues. But they may not know that Jim Cooperman, author and environmental activist, is also a self-confessed gardenaholic, someone who has cultivated gardens in various places throughout his life and for whom the large garden outside his home in Lee Creek is, in his own words, the foundation of our life. So, of course, on the basis of that last and critically important qualification, as well as many others, welcome, Jim, to Food Conversations. Now, I have a piece of bad news, Jim. And that is that the official definition of an addiction is, quote, a repeated behavior that leads to negative consequences. And since your garden has led to abundant food for your family and loads of food taken away by visitors to your home, I think I have no choice but to declare you right here on Food Conversations to be cured of your grievous affliction, your gardenaholicism.
But well, that was bit of humor, right?
This is humor. Life is all humor. Let's face it. Now, to show that you're 100% cured, why don't you describe to listeners a special feature of your garden and your gardening? And that's your root cellar. Your root cellar, the original one was made out of wood and was surprisingly durable, but the new one constructed is in a much more solid and durable fashion. So, first of all, what's a root cellar? Give us the definition.
A root cellar is usually underground where it stays cooler than the outside temperature. But the value of being underground is that it also gets the warmth from being underground and will stay above freezing in the wintertime. So it creates ideal conditions to store food.
Yeah. And your first root cellar, I mean, it's amazing how long it lasted. Describe it and what it was like getting in place. It must have been a bit of a monumental undertaking.
Well, you know, it was built back in the early 70s, and it was made out of cedar logs. And so I had to cut down cedar trees and peel the logs. And then I used a simple notch. It wasn't that complicated, just a lap notch. And of course, I had to dig a hole. and Nobel comes to mind because back in those days, you could buy dynamite at the garden or the agricultural store right in Salmon Arm.
Every kid's delight. Oh, my God. We can buy dynamite. Let's go for it.
And so because I hit rock where I wanted to have the root cellar and in order to dig it out, I had to blast that rock out of the way. Well, you know, I didn't have a pneumatic drill back in those days. We're talking about early 70s. We didn't have electricity. We didn't even have a road in the wintertime.
Yeah.
So I think I found at a secondhand store an old hand drill that basically you pound. It's a piece of hardened steel with a sharp tip that, it's like a cross at the end of it.
Yes.
And so you hit it with a small sledgehammer and turn it and then hit it again and turn it. And I did that over and over to make a hole big enough to put a stick of dynamite in.
That must have taken you an incredible amount. I worked with gas drills up in the Yukon and they took a long time, but hammering it, oh my God, you must have had the arms of a blacksmith by the time you were finished. Oh, Lord.
Well, a certain amount of stubbornness there. That's for-
But then,
but
when
anyway,
the
I managed to get the hole dug, and it was very small, maybe 8 by 10 or something, not that large. Mm. You don't need a big space for you're just storing food in there for your family. And so the next step, of course, was to build this log structure in there and then backfill it and put a roof on. Of course, you want to insulate the roof. So what I had, you know, not much money, but lots of sawdust.
Yeah. So
the ceiling was sawdust. And then there was a shake roof. Once again, I split those shakes. And so, you know, basically much of the materials were what I produced out of the forest right near our house, and built a funky door, insulated door, and it had a little vestibule porch sort of thing, entrance. And of course it had a vent, which is very important. A lot of people don't think of that, but you have to have ventilation.
Yes.
For the food to keep fresh.
Indeed.
And it worked for years, you know.
Decades. It looked for decades.
Oh, yeah. It was built in the early 70s. And I could tell things were not quite right with it by 2000 and whatever, 17 or whatever.
Yeah.
But when you went inside, it still looked good, you know. It's pretty solid, but I knew the writing was on the wall for that thing.
But you really took off with your next iteration of...
Yeah, well, then I had to take my son-in-law has a small excavator, and so he pulled it all apart. And lo and behold, those logs from the inside, they look fine, but they were paper thin. So it was a real illusion, because on the outside of those logs, they were rotten right to,
wow,
you know, right to the very edge of the inside. So
dear me.
it was time for it to
time.
Go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to have a first class root cellar, which means concrete. And, you know, although I'm quite skilled with rock work and I've done concrete work before, something like that is beyond my capabilities. So we hired a local contractor who's, you know, he said it was the smallest project he ever did. He normally does big apartment buildings and parking lots and massive projects. And here is just this 98 by 10 root cellar. But he put his heart and soul into it and did a super good job. And what really makes it unusual is the roof is just a big concrete slab.
My goodness.
That he did that concrete finishing on, and it's actually like a deck as that's part of our passion bowl. So some of the audience sits up on top of that when we have our music venue operating, and it, you know, keeps out the weather, no problem. And there's lots of ventilation. Put two vents in the front, and then I faced it all with stone, and I had him build the door so that it's got a curved top, the doorway,
like, and an so arch. Then I
yeah, an arch, and then I built a door that matches it. It looks like a hobbit door, and but you know, in typical fashion, when I do things, it doesn't always make sense from a practical point of view, because the site for the root cellar is a good site for us, because I can run to it with just my slippers on from the house. It's that close.
Mm.
But it does get sun shining on it, and so it's difficult to get it cold.
Mm.
When you need it cold. So this time of year, I leave the door wide open to bring as much cold air in there as possible. And that seems to do the trick. Maybe one time I had a bear go in there, but that's when there were apples in there. So right now I'm not too worried. I suppose some animals could go in there, but I check it every day.
You could put a screen or something over it, you know, with big mesh.
Well, there's ventilation in the door and ventilation, but it's still, you know, because It's you got the underground heat in there too, right? So it's just not. I have a thermometer. It's maybe about 4 or 5 degrees centigrade. Your fridge is 3 degrees, so it's
not bad. It's pretty good. Yeah. It's pretty good.
And right now in that root cellar, there's a few cauliflowers left. There's all kinds of cabbage. There's carrots and beets and potatoes, of course. There's some Brussels sprouts. There's leeks. The leeks keep quite nicely. Mm. There's some other assorted vegetables in there still. Oh, big, huge bag of Swiss chard.
You know,
it's quite nicely.
What's coming through loud and clear is the Jim Cooperman approach to getting things done. We keep going until it's done. We don't stop along the way. If we need help, we get it. If the rocks are in the way, we blow them up. If things need to be squared around, we do it. And I think that's been a kind of characteristic of the things you've done over the years. You know, you get started and obstacles arise, so you either move them out of the way or you work around them. Now, we're going to talk about some of your special food choices in a bit, but actually one of the first articles you said you wrote was about your root cellar.
That's kind of funny too. You know, I come up from the States back in the Vietnam era as an anti-war resistor. Mm. And I was back in the day going to university and sort of flirting with the hippie lifestyle and also very much an anti-war activist. And so I had a busy time outside of my studies, which I managed to complete in 4 years, which is rarely done anymore these days. Back in the day, it became a really major movement, the Back to the Land movement. Yeah. It was in music, it was in all the magazines and newspapers. And of course, the leading article, the leading magazine was the Mother Earth News.
Indeed.
And so we read that cover to cover every time it came out.
And the Whole Earth catalog.
The Whole Earth catalog, yeah. So when I built that root cellar, I thought, oh, this would make a great article for the Mother Earth News. And I had an ancient old typewriter, and I typed it up with photos and the whole thing and sent it in. I thought, oh, man, this is going to be great. I'm going to get published. And, of course, I never heard from them, and it went for, you know, this is before, a long time ago. This is early 70s, right? Mm. So, you know, depending on the mail. And no word from them. And finally, I got fed up and I said, well, just send it back.
So they did.
I still have a copy of it. I think I scanned it a few years ago.
Well, it's an archival, a bit of archival material. Just remind listeners that I'm speaking with Jim Cooperman, who's a well-known local author and environmental activist. Now, gardens in general were also early on in your life something that was a feature. There was a garden at the camp, that summer camp that you attended, and there was even a garden on this contested campus of Berkeley. You described it, the word funky came into it again, the garden there. So it was sort of always there in the background, and your BA was to do with sort of animal ethology and psychology kind of mixed in together. So it was kind of clear that the trend was leading, or the ingredients for understanding growing things and living things was kind of building in your sort of your repertoire. You also did some science experiments when you were in high school. Why don't you talk about the sciatic nerve of the frog?
Well, you know, Warren, I always wanted to be a scientist. That was my goal in life. Mm. And I was headed that way until the Vietnam War became such a big issue. You know, I suppose I could have come to Canada and gone to university for graduate work and carried on with that career ambition of mine. But, you know, the pull to being in nature and living off the land was stronger at that point. So, but there's always been this scientific quest and certain amount of skills and ambitions within my inner being. And so I think it sort of comes out in the gardening, because you know gardening is a lot of trial and error and experimentation and coming up with new ways of doing things and also doing research and so on. So
plus Mother Nature plays a significant role. She says, no, we're not going to do that today. We're going to do this instead.
Well, and then there's pests too.
They're her friends. They're her messengers.
Oh, yes. So in some ways, you know, my scientific ambition sort of played out in my gardening life over the.
But there was this massive transition. There was this massive transition precipitated by what was going on in Berkeley, you know, protests, confrontations with authorities and that kind of stuff. And you took a plunge that many of your fellow countrymen did, which was to say, okay, enough already. What was it that made you say British Columbia as opposed to all of Canada or any other country or whatever? What was it about the wilds of British Columbia that drew you in?
Well, it was sort of a bit of chance involved because, well, I had gone to summer camp and the older kids always went up to Canada for a canoe trip.
Oh.
But I was never able to do that. So, and that was in Minnesota, actually. So it would have been northwestern Ontario that I would have done the canoeing in. So about the second, third year of university there, it was 1967, came up in a funky old truck. And
Lucy.
Yeah, that's right. And drove through British Columbia on the way to northwestern Ontario, where my former wife and I went on a canoe trip with our little puppy. But we stopped in British Columbia, and well, actually, we were headed to Shuswap Lake, and it was pouring rain, and we ended up in a campground in Pritchard. Fell in love with the Shuswap area. And so in the following year, when the decision was made to come to Canada and look for land, we came right to Chase, and that's how I ended up here.
So how was the land, you know, you got 80 acres. That's not an inconsiderable amount of land.
Initially, that's what we purchased.
Yeah, and then there was another 80 acres later on. But 80 acres, how did you... Would you just walk into a store and say, do you have any land for sale? And
yeah, well, we walked to the realtor's office.
Yeah.
He said he had 3,000 acres for $3,000, and that was down in LeBeau Flats across from...
3,000 acres for 3,000...
No, no, 3 acres for $3,000.
Oh, okay.
and then he said, well, we have 80 acres here for $4,000.
Oh,
and
Lord.
I said, hey, we'll take it. And he said, don't you want to see it first? And I said, sure. So we drove up here. And we went up this logging road into the bush, and there's this old cabin, and there were some crusty shake cutters in it. Yeah, and we fell in love with the place. It was just a terrible mess.
Isn't it astonishing, 80 acres for $4,000 in today's
life? $4,000 is quite a bit of money.
Oh, yeah,
back
no,
then.
I agree with you. No question. Yeah. But yeah.
So. You could buy a brand new Volkswagen for $1,600.
Well, you didn't need a Volkswagen because you had Lucy with this Conestoga wagon superstructure on the back. And I actually found a list of, you published a list of, it's called personal belongings that you had to hand into customs. And it's an astonishing list of all sorts of goodies. I mean, things like bags of clothes and suitcases with clothes and books and cartons of records. And right between the ice cream maker and the banjo is a shotgun and shells. And it's interesting because later on you had to follow, it says two Winchester rifles and two more shotguns. It seems like that's kind of...
They never came.
Well, it's kind of, you know, one of the features of American society, as we all know, is that, you know, the right to carry arms is embedded in the Constitution. It was sort of like, well, all right, let's bring a few arms in. I mean, I'm glad that they didn't come, the other ones, because you had the shotgun, and I guess you must have...
I never used it.
No.
I never used it.
No. I'm very happy.
It was my dad's shotgun.
Yeah, an older model as well. But I mean, it was astonishing. You were bringing, as it were, an entire life equipment armamentarium of all sorts, clothes, tools.
Treadle sewing machine.
Yes, indeed, which was a really sensible idea. You know, I mean, you're not going to necessarily have electricity under the trees out on your 80 acres. So you came across the border. It was sort of a group exercise. There was the family, your wife and children, and friends. I mean, it was not...
Well, my first child was born in Kamloops.
Yeah, there's a picture of you using a draw knife with your son sitting right beside you, looking kind of perplexed as daddy sort of scraping away. But there was also other people along. It wasn't a sort of a solo effort. What was this?
Well, there was a few people, my partner who owned part of the property and my former wife's brother and his wife. But there weren't many of us, I'll tell you that. More people came later.
Yeah, as time went by, it was interesting. It attracted people in and it drew sort of a community around it. But you had a garden pretty quick. It was a feature. What was the first garden? What was your first garden on this land?
Okay, well, it's still there. We still grow a few things in it.
But it looks different, I can tell you that.
The trees are much taller, and so it's shadier now.
Yes.
There's a memory I have of that, in that it was sod, right? So likely couch grass, too. And so to dig the garden, you had to do it by hand. You can't even take a plow to it or anything. So there, you dig a square of dirt, plop it over, beat it with the shovel, and then wheelbarrow the grass and the roots away. And we were busy doing that. And I don't know if you remember Laurie Payne, but a famous artist that lived up Chase Creek.
Right near, yeah, yes.
He happened to come by when we were doing that, and he just shook his head, and he thought, "Oh, you guys will never last." Well, we proved him wrong.
Yes.
But anyway, it was a lot of heavy, hard work, creating the first garden. Oh.
Of people didn't continue. A lot of people, this was very much a feature of the Back to Land movement, that so many people started out, and within a few years, the hard, heavy labor you're describing just wore them down. They weren't used to doing it. They had blisters on my fingers, to quote the Beatles, and they left. But what was it, you think, that made you not leave, made you say, "I'm going to do this, and that's final"?
Well, they certainly developed a great love for the region. That's what I call myself now, as a bioregionalist, and that's basically where I was at then. You just fall in love with an area, you know. Down in the U.S. at that same time period, you know, if you had a bit of long hair and you weren't in amongst your community, you face some angry people, you know, that there was an us versus them thing happening down.
Right.
People didn't like you if you were against the war and so on. There were some towns, I remember going into a town in California, and it was like we were just by the way people stared at us, we had to get out of there quick.
Yeah, you knew it wasn't going to end
but
well.
And yet in Canada, it was the reverse, you know. I mean, sure, we got teased a bit for the long hair, but people supported us. They were against the war.
Yeah.
They appreciated what we were doing. And so having that really also helped in a big, big way, because we were able to make friends with, you know, the locals and do things with them. I never really played much music. I tried a little bit, but there was a music thing happening. We had got horses. We did. Went on horse rides.
Yeah, there's pictures of you guys riding your horses around the countryside. It looks like something out of a Western, except that nobody's got guns and everybody's smiling. You know, it's just kind of a jaunt rather than a posse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and
so Yeah.
And music became a big deal eventually.
Oh, yeah. It was huge. You know, we lived in a little tiny cabin and there were parties often, you know, more than one a week. And
you had a dynamite party after you blew out the crown for your root cellar. Yeah, was. It looks like there was any excuse for a little celebration was a good excuse.
Exactly.
So your garden. Okay, I'm imagining you there digging away like mad, sweat pouring off your brow. Everybody sort of travailing away. But when you got it prepared, what did you put in? What were the sort of things that? And how did you get them? Did you go to seed catalogs? Did you? What did you do?
I use seed catalogs now, but back then we just go to the store and buy the seeds.
Yeah.
It's just typical what we grew back then is what we're still growing now, you know, carrots and potatoes and lettuce and you name it. But there are a few vegetables, namely, I can remember one that we were really keen on growing back then. But no, we don't touch them now. And that's Jerusalem artichokes.
Now, that's an interesting story.
What's really scary about Jerusalem artichokes is that if you plant them, you've got to make sure you don't plant them like right in your garden because they have a tendency to start spreading. And if you don't watch out, they'll take over your whole garden. So you want to grow them on the edge or on a different little plot somewhere. But we found that, you know, they maybe had some decent flavor, but
but you also found you didn't reject the artichoke kingdom. You rejected Jerusalem artichokes, and then you found another artichoke that is perfectly suited to your needs.
Living in California, I certainly had a love of artichokes. So that wasn't until many years later that I began to grow
globe artichokes.
Yeah,
and they're a feature now for your garden.
Yeah, that they're a difficult plant to grow. And, when I first started growing them, I got the seed plants from a friend, or else I'd buy them at the store, you know. But now, of course, I think for the last maybe at least 10 years or more, ever since I've had the greenhouse, I've been starting seeds inside, like in March.
Indeed.
And you have that plastic shelving. It's called Gorilla shelving.
Yeah, I know it.
and then you have the most people have it in their garage, right? And then you have fluorescent lights on above each shelf. So there's four bulbs above each shelf, and then those shelves fit perfectly to trays, and so you can get 8 trays going. And so, yeah, that's how I start all the seeds inside on a warming mat. And then when they come up, I, you know, do the transplant into the 3-inch pots. And then they get transplanted into 5-inch pots. greenhouse.
They're being looked after.
Yeah, there's a lot of work involved for sure, but it's... You know, I don't look at it so much as work, but it's just fun. You know, it's something you enjoy doing, obviously.
I'll just remind listeners once again that I am speaking with Jim Cooperman, author and environmental activist in the Shoe Shop. Now, speaking of growing things, one of the things you grew unintentionally was plants, which we classify in our terminology as weeds. And I was struck by the fact that you mentioned a couple of weeds that we'd had previous guests, one who is a very active forager, had described as some of her favorite food plants. And they were lamb's quarters and pigweed. And so something triggered in my mind. I started looking stuff up. And here's what it says about lamb's quarters. Young lamb's quarters can be eaten raw or cooked like spinach. The plant contains more iron, protein, vitamin B2, and vitamin C than either spinach or cabbage. Seeds can be eaten raw, et cetera, et cetera. And then when it comes to pigweed, to my surprise, in Jamaica, pigweed is considered a culinary staple. They actually grow pigweed in plantations. And I was thinking, how hard you were working to kind of get these little suckers out of there and Now you can go out, if you see any pigweed and lamb squares in your garden, you go out and just have a munch. we can recategorize them as desirable plants in your garden. Anyway, that's just an aside. Michaela Cannon, who's a forager here, originally from Sweden, very much attached to these things. But anyway, you tried different things. You did what every gardener does. You started with some plants and then you changed. But at the beginning, you also had animals. That didn't last for some very clear-cut reasons. But talk a little bit about your goat experience and the cougar. The goat and the cougar. One day, a goat and a cougar walked into a bar and said...
Okay, you know, we had young children, and, you know, there's this myth that you have to give kids milk, right? It's very important in North America and in Europe as well, but certainly in other countries they would frown on it. But anyway, we thought milk was important. I mean, it does have, you know, great nutritional value.
Yes.
Having a cow would be far too much work. You need
too big
acreage. Yeah, exactly. So the next best thing, of course, was a goat, and goat milk is healthier for you and easier to digest and so on. And so, we got some goats and grew attached to them. Of course, we had a billy goat, and oh my goodness.
Turn your back on the billy goat, you're in trouble.
Pain in the butt.
The other thing that animals produce is manure. They give you manure, which is really...
Yeah, that's another bonus for sure. But, I mean, keeping the goats out of the garden and out of the places that you didn't want them to be was always... That's
major challenge. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we thought, well, we're going to raise sheep because, you know... my first wife was into weaving, and then we could get the wool, and then we eat the meat, and we could make some money selling lamb. Seemed like a good idea, but it required a great deal of fencing, so I had to buy all this fencing, and I fenced the bush. We sheep like to eat bush, you know. Yeah. So.
And you know, you were at the interface between the wild ecosystem and the cultivated ecosystem.
Exactly, and I used to joke that I needed to get a grant from the BC Wildlife
Federation
or whatever to feed the wildlife, because that's what I ended up doing. One day we went out, and there was our prize goat dead and had been killed by some sort of wild animal. Well, you know, the best source of advice back in those days, of course, was the neighbor who had been there many years longer than you. And so our neighbor said, well, whatever it was either a bear or a cougar, maybe a coyote, but the first two likely.
Yep.
And he said that it would come back at dusk. Well, we had, my partner had a rifle. I had one. His was better, so we used his. And so he waited up there to begin.
Because you guys were angry. This was your goat. This was a pet, kind of a pet goat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
No Viet Cong in our sights, but we certainly wanted to get a cougar in our sights. So he waited for at first, and then I went up there. We had an inkling that something was happening because one of our horses looked up there and went, you know. So we were up there waiting. I was sitting against a tree writing a letter because I, you know, didn't really believe something was really going to come show up. But I look up, and sure enough, there's a cougar about 50 feet away staring me in my eyes. And as soon as you stare at it, it turns away, right? But it was pretty frozen. And so, fortunately, I had quite a bit of experience shooting rifles from camp, 22s, right?
Yeah,
I was a pretty
the right
good
to bear
shot.
Arms.
Yeah, so I shot that cougar first right away, and that was it. And so we butchered the cougar and ate it.
And the goat. You butchered the goat.
The goat was still warm when we found it in the morning, so Dear we man. had We had meat.
Yes, indeed.
A neighbor down at the lake, we had a freezer down there so we could keep it frozen. So yeah.
But that was kind of the
you just did everything on your own, right? You did your own butchering nowadays. For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was also the beginning and the end of animals in your garden because of just it's not an easy thing to go around shooting animals in order to keep the animals that you cultivate.
And then, you know, then we had the nice lambs, and we lost 4 lambs in one night.
Wow.
And that was likely a bear, apparently.
Dear me. Yeah, it's a very difficult thing. I mean, animals do what they do. They look for their food, and if they find it conveniently located in one spot, sitting there saying, come and get me, that's exactly what they do. So you went, at that point, to growing plant food. And lots of plant food. And over the years, the garden has got bigger and, you know, more sophisticated. As you've learned, you've got a greenhouse now. You've got this colossal bomb shelter of a root cellar. But along the way, I remember one thing you told me was that you got a cooler that was kerosene-powered from the apple industry.
Oh, yeah, that was back for the milk.
Yes.
Because one thing about goat milk, you don't want it to stay warm. You have to cool it right away or it gets pretty stinky. So, yeah, we bought a old kerosene fridge and in Salmon Arm, we used one. And, yeah, that's what we used to keep the milk cold back before.
And
we
had to keep on going out to put more kerosene in it to keep it from... Otherwise, the goat milk was gone.
And then you had to adjust the wick and put new wicks in. It was a real pain. But, you know, we ended up selling it. I think we made some money when we sold it.
Did you sell it as an artifact, like a curiosity, or was it somebody going to use
it? No, just somebody with a backwoods cabin, no electricity. And, you know, this was many years ago now.
So as a result, you are now using lots of other different ways to keep food healthy and fresh so that you can use it for long periods of times. So talk a little bit about the various things that Kathy, your second wife, is skilled at, canning, pickling, making soup. How do you do that? Because that's one way to maintain the produce so it's usable over time.
We're pretty keen on putting food away for the winter, but... you know, after a few years of freezing everything in the garden, we realized that, you know, freezing peas and all those kind of vegetables, you lose so much nutrition. And so about the only thing that we freeze, well, we freeze the fruit, the raspberries and the strawberries and the currants and the cherries, they freeze well. They hold the nutrition. We don't really freeze any vegetables, but what we found is that we make soup and then freeze the soup.
Right.
And so we found that was a good way. And of course, there's the canning, and Kathy's an awesome canner. We've got plenty of tomatoes, all kinds of tomato products, and pickled beans. We don't do pickles. She does relish, which is really good. let's see, what else do we have preserved? Drying is really important.
Sure.
We do all our own tea. So we grow mint and then we add lavender and rose petals. And so it makes quite a unique tea. And this is our standard.
The Cooperman blend.
Yeah, well, it was invented by Kathy's daughter, really.
That's all right.
It's called, it even has a trade name called Revive, and it's Shop Infusions Tea.
Yeah, yeah.
And people can actually buy that in the store in Salmon Arm. Shop Infusions Tea, Revive.
Fantastic.
That's what we make. So what else? You know, a really important part of our garden is that, Kathy's been a vegetarian forever, just about. But I joined the ranks about 5 years ago. And growing your own protein is extremely important.
Okay, you've just done a segue to Romano beans.
You bet. I am
I read your mind, Jim. I read your mind.
I'm an advocate for Romano beans. And actually, it was our former neighbor who's left now, lived up the lake, Kathy's former husband. He grew them. And so he got us into them. They're the tastiest bean there is. They're quite a large bean. And they're a pole bean. So I build these huge structure in the garden, and I got two of them now. It's like an enormous fence.
Yep.
And I use the steel grid that you put under your concrete floor when you're pouring a floor.
Okay.
And so I put posts in every year and then build a framework and put the steel grid up there. And so
how tall is it, Jim?
Oh, it's about 7 feet. So I actually have to get on a little step ladder to to put the fence up and down, the trellis or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And so we were picking the beans when they were just still fresh, but not dried out. And then you have to steam them and put them in the freezer. But it's a big process. And some of the beans are green, and so we ended that one, and we just let them all dry now, and then you pick them when they're dried out, and
they change color too, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They start off green and then they turn
red.
Well, they reddish. Turn gray. Yeah, okay. they're mottled. Anyway, the bean itself. And so you have to shell them. So we still have like 3 big bags full of many. So we have to shell them at night or whatever when we're watching. Once they're shelled, you basically soak them for 24 hours. And then after that, you just steam them for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then you put them whatever you're making, whether it's you're making burgers with them or put them in a stir fry. Or we even do spaghetti sauce with them. But they're a great source of protein and really plentiful.
Just to remind listeners again that I'm speaking today as our guest on Food Conversations is Jim Cooperman, a well-known author and environmental activist in the Shuswap. So I could rattle them off, but you could also rattle off the advantages of beans over, say, beef in terms of environmental impacts. Now, I don't know if you got them memorized. I've got them written here. Do you want me to read them off? Because they're pretty astonishing when you actually look
at them. Just the amount of land and water and energy needs.
18 times less land, 10 times less water, 9 times less fuel, 12 times less fertilizer, and 10 times less pesticides of one sort or another. I mean, it's a little bit of a no-brainer when you look at, if we're going to do large-scale food production, the protein that comes from legumes is fairly astonishing in its advantage over at the environmental level. Let's talk about some of the specifics, like your French hoe. Okay, explain the French hoe, Jim. What's a French hoe?
Okay, a French hoe, and there's probably other names for it, but
no, it's called a French hoe.
That's the name we've picked.
Yeah.
It's basically a piece of steel that's at a bit of an angle, and you slide it back and forth, and it cuts the weeds off at the roots.
Yeah, it's a flat strip. It's a flat strip of steel.
Yeah, and it's grooved. One edge is grooved, and one end is just sharp. It's only about 4 or 5 inches wide.
Yeah,
and I've used it for years. It's far more advantageous than a regular hoe, because when you use a regular hoe, it's moving a bunch of dirt all the time
right.
with it.
This goes slides just under the surface.
Yeah, and you can slide it right next to plants and in between plants. Very handy. In fact, I have a mini one that's just a little piece of wire. I found that at a store one time. And it's for getting really close into little plants and so on.
And you have a maxi one now.
Yeah, well, then I just like I'm looking at my hoe and I'm looking at my rake and looking at my hoe and looking at my rake and I'm thinking, you know, someone good at metalwork could just take this rake and twist it around and take the tines off, sharpen it, and it would become a giant French hoe. So I took it down to a metal shop right near us, one of my neighbors I've known forever, and he did just that. And so now I can go in between rows with that and just do huge amounts of area, and it's really good for cultivating the garden. It's awesome.
So if you were doing your garden with your hoe, your maxi hoe, how long would it take you to sort of do a once-over in the garden?
Oh, maybe 2 or 3 hours, couple hours, yeah.
I was imagining you whipping around with this thing in like 20 minutes. You've got all of the
It's a big garden.
I know it's a big garden. I abandoned that thought.
It all depends on what the soil is like, you know. It has to be a bit moist. It can't be all dried up. And the weeds can't be too large. Mm. Once they get too large, you've got to really pull them or dig them out.
Right.
So you have to hit it at the right time and often. Weeds have the weeds we've had in our garden have changed over the years. You mentioned pigweed and lamb's quarters. Well, we don't even have those anymore. And we used to eat them when they were, you know, before our vegetables were ready.
Right.
We'd eat the lamb's quarter primarily. I don't remember eating pigweed, but but now you can't even, maybe there's the odd one in the garden now. But we have new weeds. our first weed is purslane. Mm. And apparently I eat it too, but it's a tiny little plant. And who wants to eat it?
Well, that's all right. You're for not even eating everything that's growing on your property.
Then we got one more weed, a new one.
Yes.
And it's called snapweed. And it's a little tiny weed. And if you don't look after it right away and it goes to seed, when you touch it, it snaps.
Yes.
And the seeds come flying
all over the place. Yes. Look, Mother Nature is extremely ingenious, Jim. We know we're up against somebody who is intent on carrying.
And then there's the pest, right?
There's the pest. Well, and all of the things you used over the years, you used fencing, of course, noisemakers, motion detector sprinklers, which I presume means as soon as the motion of the animal, the spray goes on, which they probably in the summer think is a wonderful little downpour and let's hang around and enjoy this. And then lately, a solar powered electric fence for the ultimate protection against intruders. I mean, you got to give it credit to these creatures. They're looking for what they want, which is food, and you got lots of it, so why not? But there's other thing you've used. You used Rime, that famous covering that you can use over there.
Yeah, you have to use that on the carrots. I mean, there are people that don't have the carrot rust fly, but we got that about, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago.
And,
there's nothing worse than your carrots full of worms, I'll tell you. And then you put them away in the root cellar and the worms keep working.
They're having a good time. And then there's sticky paper and various kinds of things like that. And then ultimately with peas, you described the fact that there was just so much problem with the peas, you just had to stop growing them. The pests were
one of the worst ones is the flea beetle. Mm. And it's a little tiny, I guess it's a beetle, but it looks like a little fly or whatever. Mm. And they love our garden. Oh, my goodness. They used to be just, we'd see them in the tomatoes, and they'd only be a problem for maybe a month, and then they'd go away. But then they discovered the peas, and we don't even grow peas anymore. Like, oof, they annihilate the peas.
Wow.
And there's very little you can do with those flea beetles. So
does it help with all these pests if you move plants around in your garden, so you plant in one area one year and another in
not too much. You'd hope it would, but I've talked to I met a fellow the other day from Enderby, and he was a real farmer and grew carrots, sold them to Askew's. I said, well, what did you do about the rust fly? And he said, well, he just would move his carrots around the field. But I mean, he had, you know, acreage, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Tractor, you know, it's a little different than growing in a garden.
Right? No, exactly.
But putting up the Remay is not too bad, and it keeps the rust fly away. And you know, we have beautiful carrots now. There aren't very many worms in them. And it, yeah, it's good. All good.
Now, one innovation that's happened just this last year is that you've got woofers coming in.
Yeah, 2 years now. This is year two. Yeah. And for all you gardeners out there that grow large gardens, or you might sell little produce, if you haven't discovered woofing yet, look it up. It's WWOOF. And it costs maybe $80 a year or something to sign up. And you get the most often there's just greatest young people, mostly from Europe. We've had them from many from Germany. That seems to be the major country where they're coming from, but also France and Great Britain and where else? Those are actually the main countries we've had them from. And then we discovered a new organization this year called Workaway. And Workaway, you don't have to pay any money. You have to fill out the forms. They got to, you got to get accepted, and it's not too hard.
Room and board?
Yeah, you give them a room and board, and you get 5 hours a day. Well, some of them like, well, this is my 5 hours. Some of them don't even care. They'll just work all day, you know. Hmm. It doesn't matter. None of them want to work on the weekends, and that's fine. But, you know, one nice thing is that they're mostly all really wonderful young people. And, you know, we're all like of their grandparents' age. Working along just great. And having them here gives us a bit more free time. So often on a weekend, we'll go on a hike somewhere else in the Shuswap. We've been out to Albass Falls. We've even taken some woofers up to Wells Gray Park. Yeah, we have a really good time with them. We've been up Enderby Cliffs. And you know, we keep in touch with some of them. You know, they're young people. They it's enough for young people to even chat with their grandparents, let alone some family they stayed with. But
yes,
we sort of keep track of them a little bit, like on Instagram and so on.
Well, they're doing things that a lot of young people really, really think should be done in the world, which is to try to make the world a better place in some fashion. It seems to me that you're giving them that opportunity, and they're bringing their, you know, sweat equity, as they call it, to help you out in that way. One of the questions that we touched on very briefly at the beginning, what your plans were years ago when you were at Berkeley, and what your sort of life trajectory would have been if you'd continued there, you know, get a BA, then you get a master's degree, then a PhD, and then you become an academic. And you've gone totally into the world of not just activism and advocacy, but also, as it were, putting your personal sweat equity where it needs to be put. What would it have been like if you'd stayed on as a professor, and now would you ever go back?
Oh, who knows, Warren? I mean, my interest back then was sleep research, and so I was pretty fascinated. And, you know, the brain is still the last frontier when it comes to science.
Absolutely.
What I was really keen on. I certainly feel that my goals changed, but I certainly have been realizing many of them. You know, I helped create 25,000 hectares of new parks in the Shuswap.
Right.
I've been advocating for environmental sanity for years, and we're not getting it, and I don't know if we'll ever really get it, but it is somewhat better than it was. The lake is still hanging in there. We haven't had too many algae blooms of late. I think the best thing I've done in my 78 years is basically write everything Shuswap, because bringing the knowledge of your place, your home place,
yes,
to as many people who live there as possible, to me is most major contribution.
Well, you know, and that's the basic premise. That's the basic premise of our station, you know, to let the community see itself. And I must confess that over the years you have charted an exemplary course in making what happens here visible, and the good things stronger, and the intrusions that are negative, set aside. I think you can justifiably have a great deal of pride in not just your garden, but in the life you've lived in this country that you adopted with such enthusiasm. Jim, it's been a great pleasure having you on the show. Thank you for being with us today, and I'm quite sure you will be continuing. You may be 78, but you ain't done yet, that's for sure.
No, not in any stretch. And this was way more fun than I thought it was going to be.
Well, there you are. Fun is all we have all day on the station. Thank you so much.
Thank you.